Okay, last chance. I'm having a hard time with alcohol. In brackets, not here. Not heavy or even daily use. A glass of wine with dinner a few nights a week or at social events. I would like to stop, but I have a hard time sustaining for more than a month or so. Your thoughts, words of encouragement. Thank you. I think one of the things is sometimes when we set up a determination, and it's like, you know, I want to stop. I have to stop this. I have to. Oh, I really want to quit. And we, all of our attention goes into restraint. I don't know what happens to anybody else's mind, but my mind goes to, like, how can I get out of this? focusing on the benefits and the actual, I want to do this. Look at the things that actually encourage or brighten the mind or the benefits that come from it, and say, that's why I want to do this. So it's like we learn how to encourage ourselves rather than trying to restrain ourselves or beat ourselves into submission. I think that's a really important perspective. And of course, that actually that applies for many aspects of the practice and training. I should meditate every day. Forcing ourselves into doing it out of duty or a sense of obligation to some idea or ideal that we set, and we forget that we actually enjoy it. Paul, when you spent time with family, did you notice any old habits resurfacing? Thank you for your teachings from the heart. So, old habits with family, you better believe it. That was like, and the thing was, is I actually stayed away from family. I didn't go back to Canada to visit family for 16 years. I went to other places, but I didn't go to visit family. I have a very good relationship with my family. Those habits are really deep. And you find yourself as a monk, I was 16 years before I went back. So I'm about 40. And you go back home, and you feel, all of a sudden, how'd I end up a little kid? what happened there? But over time, then you see those habits, and you go, okay, that's a habit. And you keep learning, and of course it's painful or shocking or disappointing to see, but you keep returning to it and reflecting and investigating, over time you realize, okay, habits, you can wear them away, you can understand them more clearly, and they don't come back to haunt one. But yeah, they're definitely there. Can you please speak about faith, how to develop it, how to maintain it through the ups and downs of practice? How have you maintained your faith over 40 years? Thing is, I haven't maintained my faith over 40 years. I didn't have much faith. So it's just grown and grown and grown. So it's a... but they, you know, I think that the aspect of faith is a difficult word for us in English, because faith assumes a belief and a kind of ability to maintain an idea or ideal, but from the Buddhist perspective, it's much more a confidence in the efficacy of the teachings, in the efficacy of the practice, in the results of the training, so that as we continue to practice and investigate and reflect, then you see, yeah, there's... We actually have confidence in the teachings become more clear, the results become more apparent, so that there's a an increase kind of confidence in the practice and the truth of the teachings, and so that and through the ups and downs of practice, it's hardly been a sort of ever onward and upward steady incline, you know. I think just so often in training and living with Ajahn Chah, and going to him with difficulties and problems, and how much he emphasized patience, just being patient, and patience is... That's another word that's kind of difficult in the English language, because when somebody says, "Oh, just be patient," usually how we interpret it, or how it's often means, is, just put up with this miserable thing for a while. You know, keep putting up with this miserable condition, But patience in the Buddha's sense, the word kanti, is much more of a maintaining an evenness or steadiness in the face of difficulty, and being open to... Being present with it, acknowledging, oh yeah, this is difficult. How can I be present with this? And so that as we're present with, and we're present and mindful within difficulties and ups and downs of practice, then again, there's an increased clarity that arises. I was wondering if the merit we have done for meditation practice can be dedicated to the people, dead or alive, we pray for. Can it be reachable to them? How do we know it? 2, also I've heard that the merit from practicing meditation will accumulate and stay with ones who have practiced that, which also carries over throughout life and or subsequent incarnations. Could you clarify this? This is something that hard to verify, hard to prove, hard to know. Especially in Buddhist cultures, and I think it, you know, goes across all Buddhist cultures, whether it's, say, Tibetan practice or, say, Chinese Mahayana practice or Theravada practices. All of the different Buddhist traditions, wherever they've gone, and really those traditions are oftentimes very, very different. Different teachings, different practices, different articles of faith and symbols. But it's interesting that, the dedication of merit or of blessings is a pretty standard through all those cultures. So, I think it's something that over time, people who have meditated, who have some kind of accomplishment, have been able to see that. I think, in terms of a, you know, on a very mundane level, I think they've done. Experiments where you have people. And this isn't in a Buddhist tradition, but where you pray for people, and then they for people who are ill, and people who have been prayed for tend to get better quicker, and it seems to be whether they know people are praying for them or not, it still seems to have a statistically significant impact. So that's on a very kind of. Not even on a Buddhist faith level, but something that is been experimented with in the West, in medical situations, that it seems to have an effect. So, but how do you quantify it? And how do you? Some of it has to. You have to accept on faith. But it is an interesting it is interesting that has been sort of tested and quantified and seems to be statistically significant. I remember there's a monk in Thailand who was a very well-known, very famous teacher. We took Chittasubha, Lumpo Panyananda. He was in the hospital when we went. Debbie was there. He's very well known, very famous. And one of the things that he taught for 60, 70 years. I mean, he was a really good, incredibly skilled preacher. And one of the things that he really devoted his attention to was trying to undermine superstitions and rites and rituals in Thailand. A tremendous amount of effort in his teaching. But he said in his time over teaching and living and observing, he said that it seemed, you know, quite clear that those ceremonies are ceremonies or internal dedications of merit had positive benefit for people, for others. Remember him giving a couple of examples when we were just sitting around talking one day. Because I traveled with him as a translator many, many times to the West. He was saying, yeah, there's a... he's from the south of Thailand, and it's all very coastal, so many, many fishermen. Said there was a fisherman who was shipwrecked. His mates were all died, and he was on his own out in the sea for a long time. I can't remember how long. But he was given up for dead. But he said that the only relief he got was where he felt some ease and comfort. He found out after it was when his family was dedicating merit. He didn't know that, but that was when he felt some ease or comfort with his hunger and thirst and the elements. And also, there was another person that he said, "Yeah, there's a woman who used to go to his monastery very regularly. She lived close by, and devout, and he would see her doing a dedication of merit." One day, and he'd seen her doing it for years, and one day he asked her, "Oh, what are you dedicating merit for? What are you trying to get?" Because sometimes there is a certain self-serving, I'll dedicate my merit so I can be rich and wealthy and famous. She said, "Oh, every day I dedicate merit so that I can die easily." And he said, "Yeah." And she got her wish. She just passed away really, no complications, no difficulties, good health up until one day, and then she just passed away real simply, very easy. He says, "Yeah." He said, "The merits bore fruit." I think that also in terms of it carrying over, because in this lifetime into subsequent lifetimes, when we approach anything with a sense of not being self-serving or self-centered, that has a real positive and brightening effect on the heart. conducive to the increase of happiness, decrease of suffering. So that any practices that we do or any conduct that we undertake that helps either to stretch or relinquish those bonds of attachment to self, those have a lasting effect. Because the opposite is also true. The things where we keep propping up our desperate attempts to prop up our self-view, self-centered activity, self-centered position, yeah, that has an effect also. Okay, many thanks to you, the Ajahns, Debbie, yogis, and all that made this retreat possible. It's wonderful. I understand that there is a Council of Theravadan Elders who are a quote-unquote decision-making panel guiding the tradition. Who exactly are part of this council, and who or what determines their eligibility to be a part of this council? Will the honor being bestowed upon you and Ajahn Amaro next month place you both in a position to be on this council? Are there other monks in quote-unquote modern times that have received this honor? You mentioned Ajahn Chah. Generally, I mean, there's no way Ajahn Amaro or I have any sort of we're way down the totem pole of and we'll always be there. But it's tends to be it tends to be much more study monks who are in administration, ecclesiastical responsibilities, belong to large monasteries that have been influential over long periods of time. It's political. You know, it's not exalted by spiritual accomplishment generally, and then from time to time they acknowledge say monks who do have some kind of qualities of either say forest monks who rarely have this bestowed on them. Ajahn Chah was one. Ajahn Buddhadasa received a title. Ajahn Mahabua in his later years. A few of the other senior forest masters. Ajahn Sumedho received a title. So those also there's a monk who's been received a lot of acknowledgement and titles, who's not a forest monk and he's not an administrative monk, and that's Prapayuto, people who will have seen. And actually, I took the lay ministry program there. That's a long time ago now. Met Prapayuto, exceptional scholar and all-round pure being, quite wonderful. And he steers completely clear of sort of administrative responsibilities. Yeah. And he's respected for it, which oftentimes doesn't happen. But it's a lot of it is tradition and there's many ancient monasteries in Thailand that have been centers of both study and say administration through the whole country for a long, long time. Okay, and would you please remind people to keep silence until tomorrow after the ceremony, please, especially in the building and rooms. Talking can be heard across walls. Thank you. Usually we break silence after morning puja, so, and then so that we come to, people have a chance to meet and talk, and then come back again for the ceremony at 9. Okay, first and foremost, bows of great gratitude for you and your generous teachings. If I remember correctly, you said with practice what can be realized is not so much the abandonment of the self, but the misperception of a self, given there has never been a self to be abandoned, correct? Thank you so much again. Yeah, absolutely. It's we don't have to abandon the self because, it isn't. It was never there to begin with. We've only assumed it into existence and believed it and attached to it. So that the and that's very explicit in the language. Pointing to the say upadana or grasping or clinging, so that the four different forms of clinging, kama upadana, so clinging to sensuality, ditta upadana, clinging to views, silabbata upadana, clinging to precepts and practices. And then attavadupadana is a clinging to the assumption of self. Attavadupadana. So the vada is sort of the assumption or belief in self. And that's the say the nature of. We assume self in different things. Particularly, so generally, the 20 bases of self. So that, assuming form, they're taking the 5 khandhas, assuming form to be self, self to be possessing form, form to be in self, self to be in form, and then with form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, or the 20 sort of assumptions of bases of the assumption of self. But it is a assumption, it's helpful to be reflecting on that because it seems so solid. It's also explicit in another stock phrase in the suttas. It's ahankara mamankara mananusaya. So anusaya are the underlying tendencies. Ahang is I, mamang is mine, and kara is making. The I-making, the mind-making, the underlying tendencies to conceit. So I'd say, these are the deep roots of suffering. But it's that we have to make the I in order it's not that it's self-existent. We make it. We create it. Of course, it's the ultimate Frankenstein. It's patched together with all anything, any odd bits here and there. Can you give a concrete description of how you recollect or contemplate? What's going on in your mind while you do it? What resources, mental formations do you use? Three vows to your wise compassion. I don't know if you want to know what's going on in my mind. A lot of it is, that's where the structures of the teachings are really helpful. Just picking up a different theme. So that sometimes that's where the familiarity with the teachings I find is really helpful. So, okay, well, picking up the Four Noble Truths. Okay, what's that? I'm sitting here. Breath going in, breath going out. It's kind of nice. You sort of drifting. You say, oh, wait a minute. Okay. Four Noble Truths. Is there suffering? What's happening here? Is there some kind of stress? Okay. Keep motivating yourself. Oh, sometimes it's like you prod the mind, remind it, encourage it, pick up different themes. Sometimes the mind just takes an interest in something, just pops up in the mind, and we take an interest and pursue it, investigate it from different angles. But a lot of it is, you know, the real, the most effective investigation takes place when the mind is quite still, quite quiet. And then we can look a bit more clearly. So that or feel it a bit more clearly. You use the thought process, you use memory to remind yourself of structures of teachings, but then you also have to remember to let your mind go quiet. You have to pay attention to the result in the sense that if it's settling, if it's getting clear, then okay, that's helpful. Because sometimes you can use the thought processes and stirs up the mind, or it just gets agitated, or it gets confused. And you go, okay, pull back and settle. But then sometimes you use those thought processes and things click when it feels clear, it's peaceful, even though you're still thinking. So you have to see the result. Similarly, sometimes the mind goes quiet and it just goes quiet and then starts getting very blurry. Lift up an investigation of some sort. What chants would you recommend as suitable to use for patients who may be on hospice or close to death? Can Buddhist monks give last rites? It depends. A lot of it depends on the people themselves, the patients. So that loving kindness chants are always very helpful. Everybody needs loving kindness, and Sometimes the recollections of refuges, like the Namo Tassa recollection of the Buddha, Buddhang Saranam Gacchami Dhammangsa, just going over the refuges is really helpful. It's very simple. Most people would recognize it if they're at all familiar with Buddhism. I've done lots of different things with different people. Sometimes, you know, we'll chant the whole paritta chants, which are the kind of auspicious chants, blessing chants, protection chants, and they're fairly extensive. Could be 15, 20, 30 minutes of chanting, and I've done that many times, and I get feedback from the nurses on the floor. I said, "Wow, that was great," and other people really benefited as well. A lot of it depends on the occasion. In terms of last rites, I mean, a lot of, say, the presence of monastics as somebody is dying is a good reminder of practice. And that's it's very traditional in Buddhist cultures, Thai culture certainly, that where you would go and visit somebody who is dying and encourage them. One is just the presence, is a visual, but then to teach or give some reflection or do some chanting so that it reminds them of their own Buddhist roots and their refuge, or the teachings themselves, so that it's a a memory and a feeling that is planted during those last days or hours or minutes, it's also say within the culture for relatives and friends to be at the side of a person who is dying and to help them maintain mindfulness or recollect. It's like Buddho, Buddho, keep them or. Recollecting the arhants, and recollect the enlightened beings, and it's because it. I mean, there's a kind of a joke in monastic circles, anyway. the old guy who's led a pretty dissolute life, and he's never really gone to the monastery, never done much of anything spiritual, and he's kind of been a drunkard, and of course it's a play on words, so it's going to come out in English so well, but the relatives are trying to recollect the arhats, remember the arhats, remember the arhats. And then the old guy sort of, what monks have tails, you know? Says, pa alai wa mihan. So it's, nuktung brahlaham, nuktung brahlaham, pa alai wa mihan. So it's the old kind of monks. So, you know, it's sort of like, if you haven't done the practice, thinking of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Arahants, peace, clarity, like forget it. It's just, you know, you need to do that in daily life. You wait for your deathbed. That's not going to work. There's also a great occasion when one of Ajahn Chah's was actually one of the first people from the townspeople and a merchant who started coming to Wat Bapong. Him and his wife started supporting the monastery, and then other people in the town started to hear about the monastery, so it got more well supported because it was quite poor, difficult circumstances. And one of Ajahn Chah's standards that he lived by all through his life, and he never ever asked for anything. Never asked for anything. So that he always made himself content with whatever came. So he, anyway, so that these people supported the monastery, got other people involved, and slowly developed, more people started coming. And of course they got older, I think at some point, and both of them, the husband and the wife, had done temporary ordinations at the monastery for some time, and left and continue raising their family. Of course, they got older, and the husband was very ill. The family came and said, "Ajahn Chah, can't remember his name right now. He's really ill. He looks like he's not going to make it. He's on his deathbed." And Ajahn Chah sort of thought for a minute. "Okay, I've got an invitation in town. In however 4 days, 5 days, I'll go there." And they were sort of, "I don't know if he's going to make it," but he didn't say anything of that. And so they went back home, and he's the father's getting, looks like he's getting worse and getting worse, and come back out to see Ajahn Chah. And says, he's getting worse. I don't know if he's going to make it. He said, no, I'll wait till I've got this invitation at the army base, and then I'll swing by after then." And they're we've supported this monastery for so long. What's wrong with it? And so a bit of grumbling, and then they go back, and the day comes, and Ajahn Chah goes to the army base. They have a blessing ceremony for something or other, and then at the invitation, they do chanting, meal offering, gives a Dhamma reflection. The army base commander says, "Is there anything we could do to help? Anything you need that we can?" He says, "I need a truck." I said, "Oh, okay." So we got trucks. It's a big army truck, and so then they went to the layperson's house, and of course the lay people are really, "Okay, Ajahn Chah's here, and the old guy is he still looks like he's still kicking," and then Ajahn Chah comes in and says, talks to them, gives a few reflections, and they do a little bit of chanting, and then he dies. And then they put him on the truck and took him back to Wadapalong for the cremation. Those are last rites. As part of my Papancha in the last sit, and having read this, it looks like it, I started contemplating my Papancha, and I noticed something. The Buddha said Vedana is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither, usually called neutral. Well, I noticed that being caught in Papancha is not exactly pleasant, but it's not unpleasant either, except when I catch it and then chastise myself for it. But what it feels like is comfortable, that is familiar, unthreatening. Would a better way to shorten neither pleasant nor unpleasant be comfortable rather than neutral? I think one of the things is, I mean, there are different ways that it manifests, but it's also, what's interesting is the result of feeling, in the sense that, and which ties into that, so that the, say, a pleasant feeling tends to result in desire, in the desire mind being stimulated. Whereas an unpleasant feeling tends to incline the mind more to aversion, negativity. But they say they neither pleasant nor unpleasant or neutral tends to incline the mind to delusion more. So it's just not seeing things so clearly. And sometimes not seeing things clearly might be sort of comfortable, but it's still delusion. Okay. I'm so blessed and feel so honored to have been here this retreat, to know you all, to receive and be guided by your teachings. Thank you. Deep, deep bows to you all. And then there was a pointing to the back of this page, which was written on the back, no gimmicks, no hassles, no worries. Which, I mean, it's already written there. She just circled and arrowed it. There's the Dhamma. But it does also say no maintenance, and there's lots of maintenance. Can you tell us what you find interesting about the breath? What insights have arisen for you from watching the breath? There. Well, it's interesting. It goes in and it goes out. It's a problem when it doesn't. I find that really reassuring. I think because what the breath is more like is a neutral space or a mirror that allows us to see more clearly what's going on behind the scenes, so that the mirror open the breath tends to just having that kind of neutral template that shines light back to the mind itself. We have lots of questions today. I don't know if we're gonna. Do you have tips for how to embody the Dhamma in worldly life? I'm thinking particularly of business situations when negotiating with aggressive individuals, aggressive business-wise, I tend to walk away at a certain point, but I'm wondering if there's another way to turn it around, make it better for everyone rather than give up. I think this is bringing Dhamma into the world doesn't necessarily either being kind of airy-fairy on a cloud, completely dysfunctional in a worldly sense, but also being able to not respond or shrink back from things that might be unskillful or unnecessary, because you can have a good business sense or a good management sense without with also being kind, being present, being fair, and having that consent. People start to trust, and I think that's in terms of being in the world, one of the things that is, I think, disconcerting for everybody is the it's hard to trust. Who do you trust? How do you feel trust? How do you gain? How do you work with trust with people? So that bringing Dhamma practice of both clarity and integrity. One can bring a certain feeling of trust to the table, and that's really helpful for everybody. Have you or the monastery ever put a publication together on the retreat questions? Are the talks of this retreat being taped? They're being recorded. And they'll go up on our website after they've been edited to a certain... There'll be a certain amount of editing to take out the worst of the ums and ahs and things. Just cleaning them up a bit. And we'll only just found out that and we've been doing that in the past, and only just found out, like on this retreat, that the indexing on our website is pathetic.
I actually just got an email from Titapo saying it's under monastic retreat, not Thanksgiving retreat.
Oh.
So we should probably change that.
Okay. So, that's a... But anyways, it was hard to find. I couldn't find it. so that we need to do something that, so that we'll get him on the case. And we have not put a publication together yet, although there is a publication in the works. It's actually not from the Thanksgiving retreat, though. It's from the Metta retreat that I did at... What year was that? 2008 or something? Karen and Susan organized that. Tom did the editing. He did a great job of that. It was a big job. It was amazing. So that's moving. And we're hoping that it will be finished for to be able to distribute. See, if we say this enough, it might happen. June the 4th is the... 20th anniversary ceremony of the founding of Abhayagiri. So we're hoping to have that publication ready to distribute. Okay, dukkha has been understood. Exclamation mark. For decades, I believe the suffering was the food itself, that cake, the pastry, more food, another bowl full. But now I understand dukkha is not the thing. It is that overwhelming craving, the feeling itself. And now that dukkha is understood, how do I tolerate that feeling? You'll figure it out. You'll figure it out. It's that recognition. Okay, that's where it is. That's actually, and that's where it can be worked with. And you start. You realize, okay, I can do this. Okay, is it possible to meditate on forgiveness for someone who died many years ago? Does forgiveness reach that person on some level? Or is it more a matter of showing compassion towards myself? With gratitude for the boundless compassion you've shown us on this retreat. The first person who receives that forgiveness is ourselves. And that's a big piece. And particularly if we think in terms of, karma manifesting over lifetimes, and if we are able to offer that forgiveness sincerely, then kind of it unties a hook or something that binds us, a karmic link to somebody, and whether it, and that's, it's helpful for them, helpful for us. How much they benefit, it's hard to tell, but certainly we benefit from it. Okay. Could you explain what your ordination names mean and how they were chosen? Usually the preceptor chooses a name, except in, say, in Ajahn Khrunadambo's case, as Ajahn Amaril gave him the name before ordination. So Khrunadambo, so one with the qualities of compassion, Jnaniko, one with knowledge, Jnana, that's what the Jnaniko, clear knowledge, Kantiko, one with patience, my name, Pasano, is one with faith, with joy. So that we all we all get good names. Yeah, nobody gets names. Sort of the depressed one, or the something to work towards. congratulations. How's the process work to get a title as you do? Is title only for monks? Would be the only one in the USA. The other Western monk who has received a title is Ajahn Jeff. He had received that a few years ago. It's specifically for monks and it's really the when somebody has given some kind of contribution, especially in as a Westerner, and Western monk in Thailand, Western forest monks in Thailand, then you're really outside of the loop of everything. Have given some kind of special contribution, for myself, I lived in Thailand for a long time. I was abbot of a monastery in Thailand for 15 years before coming to America. So I've been here in America for 20 years. So then, Abhayagiri is seen more and more as a good example of a monastery in the West and bringing Buddhism to the West. So I understand that our genetic disposition can't be changed, but epigenetics say that their expression can be modified by changing lifestyle, nutrition, stress, education, cycle work, meditation, etc. In a similar way, our karma is given, but understanding from your teachings, the expression and effects can be changed by practicing loving kindness, evaluating our actions and thoughts, investigating moods of the mind, etc., leading to less confusion and more peace, given the karma we have. Please comment. Thank you. Yes. It can all be worked with, and when we work we work with what we got, we can gain the tools of our insight and wholesome qualities through the difficulties or through whatever our karmic hand we've been dealt with. I mean, it's all possible to be learned from and understood and to cultivate a way out, a way to improve ourselves, a way to free ourselves. Okay, I often feel overwhelmed with the greed, hatred, ill will, and delusion that the corporate world exerts over the masses to the benefit of only themselves, and that is destroying the planet's ability to renew itself. One teacher instructed to not ignore what is going on, yet to also see the goodnesses and kindnesses between individuals, reflect on how many do really care about each other. It's very challenging to keep that view forefront when every turn is lined with more hype to distract and lead us into temptation. You spoke some on this topic the other night. I'm wondering if you would speak further on Buddhists' involvement, lay people and monastics alike, in one, climate change movements, one or Sangha, engage Buddhism, Buddhist global relief. These are the problems that, humanity and the planet is facing. And a lot of it is recognizing that we can actually change our lifestyle. We can take responsibility for our lifestyle. We can live more skillful lives on a personal level, but we can also be either, and depending on our own inclination, capabilities, take on the sort of proactive engagement with movements that are, and I think it's important to make choices of which movements are really grounded in integrity and principle, so that there's one feels good about the effort that you put in, because on a certain level, there's sort of the image of Sisyphus is kind of apt for that. So you have to be, the results aren't necessarily going to manifest tomorrow or next week or next year. And certainly the aspects of climate change, if you want a depressing statistic, there's lots of them out there. What do? Just sort of throw your hands up and let it go to hell in a handbasket? I don't think so. I think we need to take that responsibility. And there's a series of a conglomerate of Canadian universities did modeling of the in terms of climate. It's going to take about 1,000 years for the oceans to cool down, if they kept CO2 at the level that it was, that it is, like 2 years ago or 3 years ago, and that ain't happening. So it's, it was like when I was, I remember one time being asked, because I did a lot of work with protecting forests in Thailand, and started a non-profit there. It's still running, actually, and they're still doing a lot of work, mostly in education now, because they've gained so much experience, education and leadership. I remember somebody asking me, it's kind of all bright-eyed, do you think if you put so much time and energy into protecting forests in time, are you going to be able to, protect the forests? And I said, no. He said, what? I said, no, there's just too much greed, too much corruption. And he said, why do you do it then? Because it's possible there's enough people who will do it. You want to encourage the people who will do it. And there's enough to keep the pockets alive and flourishing, so that when people, if people ever come to their senses, then that will spread. So that's the sort of thing. If you think you're going to change the world and make everybody become responsible, and it's hard to work from that. You'll get burnt out. But if you think in terms of, can I help the people? Can I set an example myself? And can I help encourage other people who are interested in that? And then it's those seeds that will actually, I think, bear fruit. And that's something that it's sustainable to do. Okay, we're definitely, the tone of the questions is definitely moving out to the... And people were great, and I mean, it held the space of the retreat for most of the time. But you know, the ideas are percolating now, and it's. Okay, who are the senior-most monks now in the Theravada/Thai forest tradition? Can you speak a bit about the lineage? Who was whose teachers? Are there Thai teachers of your seniority who come to the West? What are some of the interesting parallels, variances, separations that have developed in the current teaching styles of the different monks? So like Goenka and Ruth Denison had the same teacher, yet develop very different teaching techniques, or insight meditation developing out of the Theravada Vipassana tradition, yet seems more focused on psychotherapy. There's not many of the Thai forest teachers coming to the West. From time to time, we'll be able to invite some of Ajahn Chah's disciples, and that's always a real treat to have them. These days, generally there's enough translators in our community to invite them. I think a part of the different traditions, it's inevitable, I think that's one of the things that in Thailand, sometimes people assume that Thai forest Thai Theravada forest tradition. It's one thing. And no. There's really a spectrum of teachings, spectrum of practices, spectrum of expressions, of practice, of training, of living. And that's that's natural. Narrow it down into an orthodoxy. I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about Thailand and Thai nature is you're never going to get an orthodoxy going. That's great. There's a wonderful acceptance of different differences, different expressions, different practices. It's quite delightful.
Organized religion.
Oh, right. That's yeah. That's priceless. There's one of our monks in our community lives in Thailand. His mother's Thai, father's Malaysian. He grew up in England, English public school education, fluent in a gazillion languages, and father extremely wealthy. And then he decided to ordain, and his father was quite upset, and expressed concern. I can't remember how it was said.
His
father saying, "I just really don't trust organized religion," and the son sort of said, "Oh, you don't have to worry." In Thailand, it's not organized. There's nothing organized about this religion.
Yeah.
Okay, hopefully this is not too personal. One, what is the, I assume, pill in the little vial that sits next to you? This is something that keeps me from coughing. It's just a, it soothes the throat. It's a Thai medicine, that Thai traditional medicine. The Kapatua. Even like you're a younger Thai, probably haven't even heard of it. Centipede pills, 5 centipedes. Yeah. It's like a cough, traditional Thai cough medicine, so it keeps from coughing. So, and I have a, especially if I'm talking a lot. I mean, I have a kind of ongoing cough anyway, so that. But if I'm talking a lot and I'm trying to keep quiet, then I've always got throat stuff going on. So that helps. And, what's the condition here, right foot? I have a various sort of body ailments. It's typical of an old body. Okay, dear Nepal, I have attended many deaths, and that last breath appears to be really difficult to relinquish. Does this training really help? I have difficulty relinquishing the small aches and pains in my body. Practice, 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 question mark. And of course, thank you. Yeah, it's just the practice, because the holding on, you know, once you start really investigating and practicing, you see, the holding on is way more painful than the relinquishing. The relinquishing is an incredible relief when you realize, oh, wow, that's where my refuge is in the relinquishing and letting go. That's, In the verse of the Manapanasati Sutta, the Buddha says, he trains us, I shall breathe in, breathe out, experiencing rapture, experiencing pleasure, experiencing the mental formation, then in and out, tranquilizing the mental formation. I know of mental formations as a translation of sankharas, but what is meant here by the mental formation? I don't know. I mean, it's just the word citta sankhara, so that it's mental. It's probably just an idiosyncrasy of the translator deciding that a way of translating. It's probably translated in different ways, but mental formations. Is there something in the vinaya or a recommendation you have to use as a reflection or phrase to use immediately upon awakening in the morning or last thing before sleep with metta and thanks? In Thai tradition, and especially the Thai forest monks, that Bhutto, 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 trying to keep that mantra of recollection of the Buddha and that's a phrase that is set, because it's a recollection of the Buddha himself. It's also a recollection of the principle, in the sense of being the one who knows, being one who is awakened, being one who is radiant. Let's say that opening up and reminding us of that possibility. So, like, beginning the day. Oh, the one who knows, the one who awakes. Bhutto, Bhutto. Ajahn Chah would sometimes ask, when you woke up this morning, did you wake up with put or to? Okay, dear Lumpa Anumodhanam, the receipt of the honorific title is a great blessing for all of us that your years of service are being recognized. I'm curious about the event. Will you need to do solo chanting, give a Dhamma talk to the assembly? What does it entail? What is the new title? Will it change the appropriate way for us to address or refer to? No, you don't have to remember the name. But it's the actual event is sort of, it's quite formal, and it's and I haven't seen it myself, so when I get back, I'll be able to give you more information. But the actual event is going to be very quick. But then, because it's a royal title, kind of given in the name of the king, and then it has other. Then there's going to be various ceremonies after that, and we'll have to give Dhamma talks. And people do chanting for us. The ceremony will take place at the palace. And then after the ceremony is done, we go to a big monastery in the central part of Bangkok, Wat Sit Kiet. And then the community there will do blessing chants for us. Then we'll go out to a branch monastery of Ajahn Chah's monastery in outside the city, Ajahn Jundi's monastery, and we'll get there, who knows at what time at night it'll be, they'll do chanting for us there. Next day there'll be all sorts of lay people, they'll do chanting for us, we'll expect Dhamma talks. Then next weekend it's going to be the same thing at Wat Nana Chat. We have a pretty limited repertoire of things we do. Chant, give Dhamma talks. Give Dhamma talks, chant. You know? Okay, if one was to choose a life partner who was not practicing the Dhamma as we know it, but had some spirited lightness about them, what are some qualities we should look for in them that would make them a good partner, one we could be happy with and continue our own development and growth. There's a particular qualities that the Buddha pointed to as the basis of a solid marriage or a solid life, sharing a life together. And first is having faith in similar things, and there's faith in the similar principles, faith in similar things. Having a similar standard of virtue and integrity, so that we hold to similar principles of conduct and living, having similar principles of and value in the sense of valuing generosity and kindness, and then having similar values of wisdom and discernment. Yeah. what did you plan to say? That's probably when I said something about I did actually kind of think, because sometimes people ask, what are you going to teach on the retreat? What's the theme going to be? I don't know. And I did kind of think before I came, maybe what I should do is really explore, say, anicca dukkha anatta, really, kind of really go into it. And, okay, that's a good idea. That'd be a vague idea. But then, so open my mouth, and different things came out. So. You never know. Yes, because oftentimes Ajahn Chah would really say, when you teach, you have to just let the mind go, let the mind settle still, and just speak from the heart of what comes out. And it's just that sense of, because it's all a certain sort of trusting the feeling that it's, one, it's coming from a good intention, two, it's hopefully sort of picking up what might be useful to others. Do you think it's possible to experience Nibbana before becoming fully awakened? Moments of enlightenment. I've heard people speak of this. But if Nibbana is beyond consciousness, would you remember that it happened? You would not forget. absolutely. That's actually the experience of experience of stream entry is an experience of Nibbana. There is no doubt left that there is not such a thing. But one's still not fully awakened. But you understand you don't have any doubt in the goal. You don't have any doubt about the path to get there. It just takes time to keep working on it. Is there a way to measure concentration, mindfulness, and awareness? Yes. Peacefulness increases, agitation decreases, happiness increases, suffering decreases, wholesome qualities increase, unwholesome qualities decrease. That's the measure. Okay, we got through it. We'll just have a quick break and come back for some chatting.